Okay, so let us go. 1 Kings chapter 11, as we kind of round off our first mini-series through the book of Kings on the rise and fall of Solomon. Today, we look at the fall of Solomon. Our message title, I went with a divided heart leads to a divided heart divides God's kingdom. I could have gone with how to wreck your life as well, but I thought maybe that was a little bit too shocking. So we went with a divided heart divides God's kingdom. But if you ever want to know how to wreck your life, this is a great way to do it. And so let's take a look. 1 Kings chapter 11, we're going to read a lot. We're going to read through most of this chapter, and then I'm going to unpack what it means for us today. So let's read together. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite woman, Ammonite woman, Edomite woman, Sidonian woman, the Hittite woman. He loved many foreign women, right? From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn your heart after their gods. Look out for this word heart. You see how much it's mentioned in this text. Solomon clung to these in love. Same word used for marriage. You'll leave your father and mother and be joined and cleave to your spouse. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines. Something is out of control, right? And his wives turned away his heart. Sounds like his heart was already turned away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God. His heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. We'll meet a Sidonian in a few chapters' time, a lady named Jezebel. And after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And so Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David his father had done. And then Solomon built a high place, a place of worship for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites. I mean, these were gods for whom you would sacrifice your firstborn children. It's evil. This is evil on a level and scale that is awful. On the mountain east of Jerusalem. So Solomon, who built the temple in Jerusalem, now put up these second places of worship to these other gods. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. And so this chapter opens with this massive problem. There's a tension. There's a crisis. What is God going to do? Solomon has lost the plot. What is God going to do? Solomon, who was a monotheist, who believed in one God, has now become a polytheist and has gone so in the way of the nation as well. He set up places of worship for proper evil gods. Remember, if you've journeyed with us through the book of Kings so far, you know that Solomon kind of came as, a second Adam to bring about a renewed Eden, a temple where God would be with his people, who would be a light to expand and to show the whole nations, the whole world, who God is and how it is to live in his ways. And so Solomon, who creates this Garden of Eden, if you will, now instead of chasing the snakes out of the garden, lets the snakes back in. In fact, even gives them a home for which they can live in the midst of this garden, just to follow this metaphor from Eden. It's amazing how bad things can get in literally just one generation. Verse 9, what's God going to do? And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord commanded. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, since this has been your practice, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of David your father, I will not do it in your days, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. It's as if David's good legacy is a blessing to Solomon, but Solomon's legacy now becomes like a curse to his son. However, I will not tear away the kingdom, but I will give you one tribe. I'll give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. In fact, it's not one tribe, but there's a second tribe in tow. It's Judah, but Benjamin is in tow with Judah. And God pronounces his judgment and verdict on Solomon. He says, I'm going to take the kingdom from you. I'm not going to do it in your lifetime. I'm going to do it in the lifetime of your son. The kingdom will be torn apart. 10 tribes will go this way, and one with another tribe in tow will be preserved for you in the life of your son. How is this going to happen? Well, God's going to bring about 3 adversaries with which to do this, 3 enemies that God will use to bring this about. Now, we're going to meet all 3, although we'll just meet 1 and 2, and we'll delve a little bit deeper into 3 for brevity and time's sake. And so verse 14, and the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite, the descendant of Esau. Jacob and Esau divided at war, and this descendant of Esau from the royal house of Edom. Verse 23, and God also raised up an adversary to him, Rezon, the son of Elida. This is a Gentile. He was an adversary of Israel all the days of Solomon, doing harm as Hadad did. And he loathed Israel and reigned over Syria. And now we delve deeper into the third one here. Verse 26, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the Ephraimite from Zereda, servant of Solomon, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also lifted up his hand against Solomon. And this was the reason why he lifted up his hand against the king Solomon. Solomon built Milo and closed up the breach of the city of David, his father. The man Jeroboam was very able. And when Solomon saw the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor. You can hear the cracks in Solomon's kingdom in the house of Joseph. And at the time, sorry, I just deleted half of that text. Let me put it back. And at the time when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, found him on the road. And Ahijah dressed himself in a new garment, and the two of them were alone in the open country. And when Ahijah laid hold of the new garment that was on him, and he tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon, and I will give you 10 tribes. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that has been chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Chemosh, the god of my ways. Verse 34, nevertheless, I will not take the kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and kept my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand, and I will give it to you, 10 tribes. Yet to his son I will give one tribe, that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I have chosen to put my name. Verse 40, Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam rose and fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So God promises to take 10 tribes from Solomon and give one tribe with Benjamin in tow to his son. But 10 tribes will be given to Jeroboam. And it's very interesting if you look at that little account there. The life of Jeroboam is he starts off as a servant to the king Solomon, and as a servant he excels and he does well, and he gets promoted by the king, and then ultimately the king's heart changes, and God promises to make Jeroboam king, at which point the king starts to try and kill the new prospective king. You've heard this before, hey, in the life of Saul. Saul, who's the great king, and David, the young man, excels and thrives and does well under the king to the point where a prophet comes and makes David, says, you're going to be the next king, at which point Saul loses his mind and begins to try and kill David. Now, the same thing that happened to his father is now happening through him, and this is coming to bear. And so what ultimately happens in Solomon's life, how does Solomon's life end? Verse 41, now the rest of the acts of Solomon, all that he did and all his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? Where is that? We have no idea. They literally are lost to us. And the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem all over Israel was 40 years. And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father. And Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his place. Let's pray. Father, as we come to your word, would you speak to us? Would you show us of who you are? Would you show us Christ in light of who you are and what you've done, how we can live. Give us wisdom for life, we ask, and make us more like you. Amen. Okay, so as we look at this text in this chapter today, I want to try and pull the big theme for us and apply it to our lives. So today, the big idea is this. There is only enough room in your heart for one God. There is only enough room in your heart for one God. I could have given the big idea this. In Jesus' words, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, or with all your strength. And the first 11 chapters of the book of Kings, especially if you've been journeying with us, you'll know details the rise of Solomon's life. But the whole way through, we become aware of these cracks in his life. And ultimately, in chapter 11, we see his fall today. It's a tragedy because although God did so much good through this life, ultimately, he dies in shame. And the issue is devotion. The issue is love. The issue is exclusive love, exclusive devotion, exclusivity to his God, and it should have been exclusivity to his wife as well, and that disappeared as well. There's only enough room in your heart for one God. What God requires from us is exclusivity. It's incredible how strong the language of love comes through in this chapter. You saw time after time the words that were repeated. How many times? I think four times the word heart is repeated. Wives, marriage, loved, clung. The issue, the crisis that the author wants to draw our attention to is one of marriage, of covenant relationship, of devotion, of worship, if you will. Ultimately, it's an issue of heart, an issue of love, an issue of devotion. It's an issue of exclusivity. If I was to pick one verse from this whole chapter that sums up the issue, it's this, verse 4 with the tail end of 5, or the beginning of 5. For when Solomon was old, his wives, and here's it, turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father, for Solomon went after. His heart wasn't exclusive. His heart was not wholly true to the Lord. And if you've journeyed with us for the previous 5 messages, you would have seen these amazing things that Solomon had done. But you would also have seen these little questions throughout the journey, these little cracks, these little hints that say something, although there's extraordinary things happening in his life, something is not right here. And so far, the author hasn't been explicit about Solomon's unfaithfulness to God. But it's almost like every chapter, there's a little question. Oh, but what about that? We see Solomon accumulating horses and chariots when in Deuteronomy the kings were forbidden from doing so. We see Solomon amassing huge amounts of gold where, again, kings were forbidden, taking twice as long to build his own house that was twice as big as the temple. And these things are not condemned as we're reading them, but you're left asking, wow, what's up with that? It's as if we see in Solomon's life this lifestyle that just becomes so grossly opulent. It's obscene, really. He's so wealthy and so powerful that although it's not outright spoken to as wrong, we just start to question these things. He's doing all the right things, yet there's these questions all the way. And so we've seen him establish the kingdom. We've seen him choosing wisdom. We've seen him showing justice alongside mercy. We've seen him outstanding governance. We've seen him building the temple. We've seen Queen of Sheba coming to learn. He's a light to the nations. But all is not well in Solomon's heart. These cracks have been showing. And as Solomon has grown in success and power, it's as if he's become more self-reliant and more self-indulgent. And maybe we could say what was there almost in trace amounts has now taken over his life. 1,000 women, a harem of 1,000 women. Maybe what was there in trace amounts now has become out of control and it's dominating his life. It's almost as if when he was young and he faced challenges. Challenges that brought him to his knees, challenges where he was dependent on God. It's like those challenges perhaps brought him closer to God. And as he's grown in success, he's changed. Now, I don't think success is a bad thing. But I do think, and I think it was Rigby who said this, he says, success will find you out far faster than failure ever will. Success has a way of revealing what happens in our hearts exposing what's really there. Maybe even more than hardship. I mean, we say pressure reveals what's in your heart, and I know that's true. When I'm under pressure in my life and I'm under stress, some of the worst, darkest parts of my heart come out. They manifest themselves. But I think what we see here is so too does success. We've seen this in celebrity culture, right? Some new sports star comes along and they just, they hit, everything that they hit turns to gold, or some singer or some actor, and they, and it's not long before suddenly their internal world implodes. And you have to wonder, or I'll find myself wondering at times, I wonder, had this person not been so successful, would they really have blown up like that? Maybe in the pressures of ordinary life would have kept them humble and almost would have kept those things on a leash. However, that's not the case in Solomon. Michael Eaton says of this passage, he says, worldly glory has a tendency towards spiritual ruin. And that's what we see in Solomon's life. It's amazing how success goes to our heads. Power goes to our heads. Maybe what started out as God's law in Solomon's life became, yeah, and it's one of many ways. Maybe that's your opinion. It's a good idea, but I think I'll do this, God. And these little snakes that Solomon let live in the garden of his heart had now grown up and they'd taken over his life. Maybe when he was younger, his heart was more for God, and these issues were there, but God was at the center, and so these things were on the side. And over time, as Solomon didn't put those things to death, those issues from the side came to the center, and God got relegated to the side. Why is this important? Because what I'm getting at is none of us are perfect. All of us have got little snakes that live in our hearts. But as long as the trajectory of our hearts is more toward God at the center and these other things away from these other things waning in devotion, I think you're doing okay, which is why maybe in Solomon's life, they weren't outright condemned as we saw them there. Perhaps at that stage of Solomon's life, God was at the center and these things were kind of waning. And some at some point that changed. As you become a Christian, you know and I know that sin doesn't just disappear from your life. But sin, when you become a Christian, goes from something that we loved to something that we struggle against. It goes from an ally to an enemy. It goes from something we loved to something we loathe. But as we grow, Christ becomes more at the center and these other things wane. And for Solomon, this happened the other way around. It seems Solomon stopped struggling against these things and started loving these other gods. And maybe it's worth pointing out that before the God had a name like Chemosh or Molech, probably if we look at Solomon's life, we'd say, no, those were the means. The real idol, the real God behind them in Solomon's life, money, sex, and power. I'm so glad we've moved on as human beings from these things all these years later. You say, you look at Solomon's life, all these good things done, but yet you can track. Oh, you can see him falling in love with power. You can see him falling in love with money and the gold and the chariots and the horses. And you can see him just 1,000 wives. Sex is quite clearly an issue in his life. And it's amazing how these remain maybe, and I'll use the word idols, the same idols that circulate in our own hearts today, in our own culture. Maybe you push back, you say, but Luke, I thought Solomon was wise. He was. But here's the problem with wisdom, and we see this in Solomon's life, is wisdom, even wisdom is subject to our loves. Even wisdom is subject to our loves. The same wisdom that enabled Solomon to govern a nation and to build a temple was the same wisdom that enabled him to manage a harem and build temples for these other gods. The wisdom didn't disappear. The wisdom was downstream. It was at the mercy of his love. You can have wisdom. You can have education. You can have intelligence. These are not bad things. But I want to say that these things are at the mercy of, these things are downstream of what you love the most with your life. When the Enlightenment happened in history, There was an explosion of education. Suddenly ordinary people could go and study in university. And there was knowledge, there was education, there was science. And we thought to ourselves as human beings, now we can solve the world's problems. We got education, we got science. Now we can solve the problems of the world all on our own. We don't need religion anymore. Now we can do it. And what happened? There have been more people who've died in wars since the Enlightenment than ever before because we just found cleverer ways at harming each other. I'm not saying education is bad. I'm not saying science is bad. I'm not saying wisdom is bad. I'm just saying that those things are downstream from our hearts and our desires. There's something more core and fundamental to being a human being, the center of who we are, that even our wisdom can't curb. Our wisdom is shaped by those loves and desires, what we worship. Peter Leithart, in his commentary on this chapter, points out something that is so profound. I'm going to try my best to explain it here, but in the original Hebrew, it's not visible in the English, but there's a pun that the author is showing us on Solomon's name. Angie, can we bang this one up here? So this is Solomon's name in Hebrew there, and I draw your attention to the end of those two Hebrew words. You'll notice that they're identical. This is the word that was used for wholly follow, wholly devoted to God. Remember that in that key verse, verse 4. Solomon's name and Solomon's devotion, wholly devoted to God. This is what a pun looks like in Hebrew. And it's as if the author is saying Solomon's name tracks with his wholly devoted to God. Solomon's name tracks with his devotion to God. Solomon's person, who Solomon is tethered to his devotion to God. You following with me? The very best version of Solomon's self, his very name, tracks with his devotion to God. When Solomon is exclusive to God, we see the very, very best version of Solomon. Who he is as a person, the person he becomes, is tied to his devotion and how fully devoted he is to God, or not. And tragically, in Solomon's love for these other gods, he's ceased to be the most true, best version of himself. In other words, Solomon ceases to be Solomon and he becomes a shadow of himself when he is not fully devoted to God. Only when God is at the center of life is Solomon experiencing the fullness or living into the fullness of what it means to be Solomon as he's created to be. But when something else, money, sex, power, whatever you put there, becomes at the center of his life, it reduces who Solomon is and who Solomon becomes. His very self is diluted. He becomes a shadow of himself. I'm making the point that you become like what you worship, but you are your most true, best version of yourself when you put God at the center of your life and you put anything else at the center of your life. You will become a shadow of yourself. You will reduce yourself. You've seen this, as I have seen this, if you've ever loved someone who struggled with an addiction. Perhaps you've got a family member or friend who's battled with an addiction, and this person has put something at the center of their life, and it's got a hold of their life. And you knew what they once were. You know what their potential, what they're capable of, because you've seen it. And you've watched as this thing at the center of their life slowly reduces who they are as a person. It's heartbreaking to see. But you see this in Solomon. As Solomon makes these other things the center of his life, he actually ceases to be his actual self. Idolatry doesn't just alienate us from God. It doesn't just move us away from God. It actually alienates us from ourselves. And it diminishes our very selves. And this is because to be a human being, and we see this in the life of the wisest, perhaps most powerful person who's ever lived, we see this in his life, to be human, even this extremely wise, wealthy, successful person, even him, how much more true for you and me, to be human is to crave something or someone to center your life around. There is no complete within yourself, because to be human is to worship something else. To be human is to be incomplete, to need something to complete you. There's a God-shaped hole in all of us, as someone once said. We are born and we live and we die as creatures who derive joy and meaning and purpose from something outside of ourselves. This is what it means to be human. Call it love, call it worship, call it orientation. You orientate your life around something else. Call it what you want. But human existence is one where we all desire, we all crave, we all need something outside of ourselves. And I'm saying to you that you put anything else at the center of your life, you actually, without realizing it, are diminishing yourself. The only way to become the very best version of yourself, and we see this in Solomon, in this beautiful pun that the author sticks here for us, is to make God the center of your life. As human beings, every one of us worships something. The question isn't what do you worship? It's what do you worship or who do you worship? Perhaps if you're in our church, you've heard me share this quote before from David Foster Wallace. David Foster Wallace, brilliant mind, atheist, tragically, ultimately took his own life, but was speaking to a group of university students at an address. And this is a part of a famous speech that he gave. He says, because there's something else that's weird but true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. He himself an atheist. There's no such thing as not worshiping because everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is pretty much everything else you worship will eat you alive. Solomon worshiped money, sex, and power, and this extraordinary life was ruined because it ate him alive. If you worship money and things, then you'll never have enough. You'll never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. On one level, he says, we all know the stuff already. You know it, I know it. You become like what you worship. Solomon became this lustful, divided, power-hungry, greedy, arrogant king. And it ruined his life, and it even ruined the life of the generation that came after him. In a sense, his kingdom was protected in his life because of his father's goodness. Something David had done right. David wasn't a perfect man, we all know that. But something of David's life was a blessing passed on to Solomon. And something of Solomon's life, because he centered his life on other things, became actually a curse to the kingdom of God, to his own family as well. You become like what you worship. The flip side of that is also true. When you've got the right thing that you center your life on, you become like what you worship. The very best version of you begins to well up and gush out of you as you center your life on Christ as well. And so, probably worth just stopping. What do you center your life around? I mean, Solomon didn't start out as this bad dude who decided one morning to wake up and wreck his life. Here was a guy who served God faithfully, built the temple, prayed, led the nation to God, was selfless in how he wanted to lead and love his people. But over time, his heart drifted from God. We might be naive to think that the same is not true of us. What are the sort of things I'm talking about? Well, Tim Keller couldn't preach about idol worship without mentioning Tim Keller. Not because he's an idol worshiper, but because he articulated so well for us this stuff. He said this, what is an idol? Anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give. Anything that is so central and essential to your life that should you lose it, your life would feel hardly worth living. Whatever controls us is our Lord. The person who seeks power is controlled by power. The person who seeks acceptance is controlled by the people that he or she wants to please. We do not control ourselves. We were controlled by the Lord of our lives. We all worship something. David Foster Wallace said it so well, everything else will eat you alive. But God, why is Christ different? Because everything else wants something from you. Christ gave up everything for you. There is no king, there is no person, there is no commodity, There is no ideology as selfless as Christ. That's why you can trust him. Peter Lightard, in his commentary of this passage, says the very best version of Solomon is Solomon with God. Solomon with God. There's no on your own. Solomon on his own, Solomon is only himself when he is centered on God. When his heart loves something else, he becomes a different Solomon. The very best version of you is you and God. You centered on God. Orientated around him. It's the way you have the most, it's the way your nature becomes the most beautiful way of being human. It's the way you leave a legacy that impacts the next generation in a profoundly blessed way. It's the way you can live a life of purpose and meaning and impact for the good of others, the very best way. So our big idea today is there's only enough room in your heart for one God. And only when this is true will you become the very best version of you. Jesus, many years later, said, "No one can serve two masters, for you will hate one and love the other. You will be devoted to one and despise the other." It's a simple message. It's helpful to remember that better men and women than I have ruined their lives like this. Solomon, case in point. And so it's to us to stay humble, to stay hungry, and to keep Christ at the center of our lives. Maybe before I lead us in prayer, just one question for reflection. How are you actively keeping Christ at the center of your life? This doesn't happen automatically. How are you actively keeping Christ at the center of your life? How are you centering him, not just in label, but in practice, in your habits and in your life? How do you actively keep Christ at the center of your life? Maybe as we approach Easter, Easter is going to be hopefully public holidays for you, more time to reflect, maybe a break, maybe some leave. But this week is an opportunity for you to think to yourself, hey, this happened to Solomon. I don't want to go the way of Solomon. What does it look like to center my life around Christ? How am I actively doing that in my days, in my weeks, in my months, and in my year? Can we stand together and invite the band, the Benestat band, to come and lead us? I'll give you just a second to reflect. I really believe God is with us this morning and he's speaking to us. Who are you becoming? Are you becoming the very best version of yourself because you have centered yourself on the one and only God? You see, as Solomon grew in power, he became more selfish and more self-indulgent. And yet Christ came, Christ the King who came in the line of David, the tribe that was preserved in David's lineage, so brought Christ into the world. You see, later Solomon came in the line of David, but later than Solomon came another king in the line of David. And this king didn't accumulate horses and chariots and gold. In fact, this king didn't even build the temple, but he tore the temple down and he gave his very body as a new temple that was broken and then brought back to life in order that we in his kingdom could be restored to life. This king forsook gold and riches and horses. He emptied himself in order to save those in his kingdom. That's why you can trust him. That's why you center yourself on him, because everything else in the world at some point has got the hooks and will require more of you than they gave to you. Not so with Christ. Jesus, freshly as your people, we center ourselves on you. You are my God and I am your child. Forgive me, Lord, where I've looked to other things. Forgive me, Lord, where I've hoped, where I've thought if I just had that thing, then my life would be. And freshly, Jesus, I declare this morning that you are the center of my life. Give me wisdom, Jesus, that would help me to orientate my life, my days, my weeks, my year around you, Jesus. That as my days progress in this life, I would become more like you, a greater blessing to my descendants, and more fruitful as a minister of your kingdom in my world as well. Pray in your name, Jesus. Let's worship and let's reflect together.